history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that need to be told. We aim to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we're going to hear today definitely has inspirational power, but it also comes with a reality that I've never had to deal with in 15 years of interviewing World War II veterans. I want to share this up front so nothing is misleading today, and I guess I need to explain that the interviews you hear on Hometown Heroes are recorded ahead of time, usually a week or two before you hear them on the radio. And just as I was getting ready to distribute this week's program to our affiliate stations, I received word that the World War II veteran you're going to hear from today, Dr. Bill Cott of Anaheim, California, had passed away on Wednesday, January 8th, 3 months shy of his 98th birthday, and just 8 days after we sat down with him to record his story. With his family's permission, we're going to share that conversation with you today, and I guess it underscores something that's always been a driving force for this program and so many parallel efforts around the country to preserve veteran stories. It's the urgency. If we wait too long, these stories and the value they present for our present and our future will be gone. I know some of you listening right now have veterans in your family, and you've thought, maybe I should ask so-and-so about what happened way back when. Well, I hope you'll act on that inclination and not put it off. Dr. Bill Cott survived the Battle of the Bulge. He witnessed evidence of horrendous atrocities at the Buchenwald concentration camp. And when he came back from World War II, he got married, started a family, and went on to become a dentist, then an oral surgeon, and even went back to school to become a medical doctor. He was on the city council in Anaheim and even spent some time as mayor pro tem. But as always, we tried to start the conversation at the beginning, when Bill was the only child of German immigrants growing up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it was very unique. It was Depression years. Things were tight, tough to get a job, very tough. I moved out on my own when I was 16. I had a few sleepless nights, but I finally found a room. I found a job. You may not know this. I doubt that you do, but the work week before World War II was 48 hours, and the pay was 30 cents an hour. So I worked all week, 48 hours, for $16.
What kind of work were you doing?
It was in a department store. I was stock boy. Then the war came along. I figured, boy, maybe that's a good deal for me. I get clothing. I only had one change of clothes. And I get clothing, medical care, and friends. So the next thing I knew, I was in the Army. I went to various places. One place was a citadel where I learned a lot. They sent me there, I guess because of a psychological test I took. Then they sent me to the University of Maine. And while at Maine, I met my wife. We decided to correspond and so on.
What was it about her that caught your eye? What do you remember about meeting her?
Oh, she was a very attractive girl, intelligent, and I just liked her. And I transferred around to various camps. I found myself in France with Patton. I was assigned to the Third Army. We had a few skirmishes there.
Let me take you back a little bit. I'm curious about this because a lot of people seem to remember a specific date and where they were and how they heard about it and what it meant to them. But December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, do you have any memories of that news?
Not really.
Okay.
Because I wasn't living a normal life. It was just another day for me. I just don't remember, except we all thought it was a terrible thing, and we knew that war was imminent even before it happened. We knew we were going to be at war.
And I'm curious, too, especially in light of everything you've accomplished in your life It's not most people who have gotten a dental degree and then become an oral surgeon and then gone back to school to become a medical doctor. That's a pretty unique combination. And if you tell people, oh, yeah, he'd left home as a teenager, then it's a little even more shocking. So I'm curious, when you left home as that teenager, what were your ideas? What were your ambitions and dreams?
Well, I didn't drop out of school.
You graduated early.
High school.
At age 16?
Yeah. Well, I had just turned 17. April and May, I graduated. I went to a school that was called Central High School. They didn't give you a diploma. They gave you a degree. It was endowed by the state of Pennsylvania. They taught only foreign languages, English, math, and things like that. No commercial, no industrial courses. So I have a good record high school. Well, the degree is here somewhere.
With a few others and, that you've earned since.
Among five others.
So did you have ambitions or thoughts of medicine at that young an age?
No. My ambition was to get a place to live so I could be a human being. I wasn't happy roaming the streets of Philadelphia wondering what's going to happen to me because I had nobody. So the Army put me in shape. I had a family and a place to live.
So it wasn't a difficult adjustment for you to get used to the Army way of life?
It's always difficult because your freedoms are really taken away. You have to abide by what they tell you. And that's okay. It was all good stuff then. What it's like today, I don't know.
You know, sorry for bouncing around, but another question that occurred to me. You know, most of us alive today, and most of the people listening to this, didn't live through the Great Depression. And we live in a world where you have one of these devices, the world is at your fingertips every instant. What's the biggest difference you see between today and those times there? And is there some perspective that you have from living through those times?
The biggest difference is that people then were more genuine than they are today. When I grew up, it was a sin to tell a lie. You didn't talk about it. You knew it was a lie, and you just shut up. That's what we were told. People today, you can't believe them. You know, I don't believe anybody unless I know it to be a fact, because that was inculcated into me to be straightforward and honest about things. And that's the way it was in those years. You had to abide by your fellow citizens.
And what was your wife's name?
Eleanor.
So you said you met her in Maine.
Maine.
You wrote letters and stayed in touch while you went
overseas? Yeah, as well as we could. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy. I was moving around quite a bit.
Did you already have that thought in your mind that you may come back and marry her?
Well, it was a possibility.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
So then you head overseas. What were your specific duties in the Army? What did they have you doing?
Infantryman. It's that simple. An infantryman is an infantryman. I had a rifle, I had a bayonet, and I killed people.
Did you feel that your training prepared you for what you ended up encountering?
Oh, yeah. We had good training, good equipment. Everything was terrific.
And what's your first memory of combat, a welcome to the war kind of moment?
First of all, to answer that, I have to describe the atmosphere, sort of. Do you know where the Battle of the Bulge was?
You betcha. It was happening right now, 75 years ago.
Where?
Well, in a lot of places. My grandfather was at Bastogne, which was one of the wars.
Bastogne.
Where they were
cut
off.
Where I was. Yeah. I was at Bastogne. What country is that?
That would be Belgium.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Hey, you're one of the few people. He knows that.
You're quizzing me, huh?
The Bulge was in Belgium. I was in Bastogne, and every day, and I mean every day, there was not one nice day. It snowed, cold, rain, hail. It was terrible. Now, when you watch television today, you see them coming down, going into for breakfast, and so on. We didn't have that. We were living like animals. We ate out of a can, no latrine. We went where we could. No place to sleep, under a truck or a tank. Patton was a tank guy. It was like living like an animal for a year. And the weather was terribly cold. It was the coldest winter on record in Europe in 1944.
Well, let's just stay right there with those conditions, because most of us have never dealt with that. And you just described that you're living like animals. Were you able to dig foxholes, or was the ground too hard?
No, we didn't dig foxholes. We slept in a truck or under a truck or in a tank or wherever we could. And every night there was a different password. The password was usually some well-known American like, you say babe, and if they didn't say Ruth, they're dead. There was no question. You just shoot them. And Patton did not want any prisoners. He said, you're in the army. If you don't kill them, they'll kill you. So take your choice. And so if they didn't have the right password, that's it. That's what we had to do throughout Belgium. And then we went into Germany, of course. And I could tell you about that if you want to hear it.
Of course I do. But before we wrap up this, you know, discussion about the weather, you just said it. It was the coldest winter on record for
decades.
That's right. How did you personally experience that? Did you deal with frostbite in your fingers
or
toes?
No, I was very fortunate. See, I was young. Everybody was young. That's the only reason we survived. If you and I would go there now, we'd die. You're young. They did supply good clothing, good equipment. We had everything we needed except a restaurant, food, latrine. There was nowhere to sleep. It rained. You just had nowhere to go. You just had a piece of stay out there.
But the weather wasn't the only thing that could kill you. You had the German army on the other side with their artillery and their small arms fire.
Yeah.
Eventually planes flying over that could drop bombs. I'm sure there are mortars, landmines. What were some of the hazards that you became all too familiar with?
Well, gunfire. It was close-up stuff.
I'm guessing, knowing the nature of what you did and having spoken to a lot of men who were in similar positions to you, that at some point you had to deal with the reality that guys around you were getting wounded and killed.
Well, we all had a job to do. We didn't pay much attention to other people, of course, unless they needed help or something. In France, there was a group of us standing on a hill, and there was a church right there beside us. Suddenly, I heard some voices down in the valley. I looked down. There's about 75 Germans. So I said to the guys, follow me. And I ran up into the church. The belfry was there and so on. And we had a distinct advantage shooting down at them. And we killed them all because they were coming up the hill. They didn't have a chance. So that's the only time, you know, you really have contact with others. But there's contacts from time to time. No one complained. If they were wounded, medics would come and just take them.
And you were never wounded?
No. Very lucky.
I imagine you may have had some close calls.
Oh, yeah. There were close calls.
Care to share any of those stories that you remember?
No. No, there were close calls. That's enough, you know, stuff for overhead. And what's there to say? Bullets going by. I just did what I had to do, and I think I did a pretty good job. The French gave me that plaque. They sent an ambassador over after the war and gave me that plaque for saving that church for them.
If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can find a photo of Bill Cott with the French Legion of Honor medal pinned on him. You'll find a short video of Bill as well. And there are more photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, including one from the 1960s when Dr. Cott and his wife Eleanor hosted a Hollywood actor turned would-be politician that you may just recognize. Before we're done today, we're going to hear from Dr. Cott's son as well. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a unique situation with the story of World War II veteran Bill Cott, a survivor of the Battle of the Bulge, witness to evidence of the Holocaust at Buchenwald, later a dentist, an oral surgeon. In fact, he continued to perform oral surgery until the age of 89. Bill passed away this week at the age of 97, just 8 days after recording this interview. And we would not have had the opportunity to meet Dr. Cott if I hadn't been clued into his story. Almost all the veterans we hear from on this program are people we meet because of you, the listener, passing along a recommendation. In this case, about a year ago, Dr. Cott received a heart valve replacement manufactured by Edwards Life Sciences, a company that holds an annual ceremony in Orange County around Veterans Day to honor all the vets who have benefited from those heart valves. Dr. Cott was one of those honored this past November, and I want to thank Heather from Edwards Life Sciences for connecting me to Dr. Cott and his family. You're going to hear from his son, Paul, before we're done. But to catch up to where we were with Dr. Cott, he had excelled at Central High School in Philadelphia, a magnet school that goes back to 1836 and is the second oldest continuously used high school in the country. He had joined the Army Specialized Training Program and studied at both the Citadel and the University of Maine, where he met his future wife, Eleanor. But when troops were needed in Europe, he was sent there to become part of General George S. Patton's Third Army. One of the questions I asked him was, what was the most difficult or challenging thing he had to deal with in World War II?
The most challenging, difficult for me was killing people. But that's what I had to do. That's why I was there. I don't like that.
And did you ever meet Patton? Were you ever
around him? Oh, yeah. We met him. He come out and talk to us. I don't have one, but there are pictures of him peeing in the Rhine River. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Uh-huh.
Have you?
Yeah, and it was interesting that he did that. At least he said he did that because he thought he was the reincarnation of Julius Caesar and Napoleon, who had both done the same thing.
Oh, yeah. And he's right. I think that guy won the war.
I've talked to quite a few guys who served under him, and to some, his bravado was very inspirational. I've also heard the other side where some guys said, yeah, old blood and guts, our blood, his guts, and they felt that they were the price that he was willing to pay. What did you get out of him being the leader of that Third Army?
The thing is, you're expressing the feeling of today. Young people in particular, and through the years, they get insulted if you're a little bit bravado. But you're in the Army. You got a war going. You can't always be a nice Joe. I mean, what the hell do they expect? You know, you got to be forceful to win a war. And that's what he was. And that's what he did.
How often did you hear from Eleanor?
Occasionally. Not too much, because it was difficult to get mail under those circumstances. But when the war was over in Europe, and I emphasize in Europe, after we left Buchenwald, the war wasn't over. Everybody thinks the war was over. It wasn't. We were still fighting the Japanese. So Eisenhower came over and talked with Patton. He wanted 200 soldiers to spearhead the invasion of Japan, 200 of his best soldiers. Unfortunately, I was one of them. I didn't like that. We were all tired, so we went to Japan. And in the meantime, Roosevelt died. Truman became president, and he dropped a bomb on Hiroshima August the 6th, 1945. Remember that for the next exam. They didn't give up. We were on a boat going down.
You were on your way to Japan when the bomb was dropped.
Uh-huh. And then the next thing, we were already there, really. He dropped another bomb August the 9th, 3 days later, on Nagasaki, and they gave up then. Nagasaki was just leveled. Oh, there were a few tree stumps and so on, but anyway. So what they did is they wouldn't let us go out into the radiated areas. So we just waited until we got discharged, and I'll tell you about that later if you want.
Well, there's a couple other things I need to circle back on with you, I think, because earlier you said after you were done in Belgium and after the bulge was repelled that you went into Germany, and you said, I'll tell you about that later. Sounded like you had something in mind about your experiences in Germany.
Well, we crossed the Rhine. The Rhine River separates Belgium from Germany, as it does France from Germany, south. We made our first stop, Luxembourg. Nice antiques, trolley cars, everything was good, and I spoke with them. Then we went south and eastward into Bavaria. Every large city, as I understand it, in Germany has a gymnasium, several stories. I forgot the name of this one, but there was a guy up on a balcony when I came over. I was more or less alone at that time, but I had my finger ready to go. He looked wounded, and I just couldn't shoot him. You know, they all had large cans of lard for food. He had one, and I just let him alone and left. And we went on to Buchenwald. See, there was always a contest between Patton and Montgomery, the British guy with the sweater. We were the first ones to come into Buchenwald. Bodies all over the ground. Well, not really bodies, just skeletons. Skeletons all over the ground. The Germans were afraid of us. They didn't want to be confronted by us. They all took off, the German soldiers. We went in there and saw the ovens. There was two ovens in the shower room. People would say to me, there was no such thing. Well, I saw them. German ladies from our church were telling me there were no such thing. I said, that's baloney. I saw them. We were there about a week and cleaned things up. And cages where people would sleep. I don't know where they got the idea. Treat people like animals like that. And by the way, we walked. This was all walking across Germany. Suddenly, about 3 days later, Eisenhower cut our supplies off, our gasoline, and so on. And we didn't know what was happening. So we found out later that the problem, if you remember your history, there were two treaties with Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. And then the next one was with Truman. They made a rule that you don't go past the German border. So, but Patton did, and he was right to do that. We all were for him because what he was doing was he was going after Stalin. He hated Stalin. Oh, it was amazing. In fact, I think the Russians killed him on the Autobahn. I really do. I don't think that he was in an accident. I think he was killed. And so did everybody else, not only me. But it came out it was an accident.
So Patton had you guys pressing on toward the Soviet forces.
So right.
But Eisenhower now, had your supplies cut off, so you couldn't go that way.
Yeah. So then we went back to Germany. We marched back there. Next thing we knew, Eisenhower came out. We went to Japan. At least I did, along with 200 others. Then I was discharged at San Luis Obispo.
And you've been in California ever since?
Yes. I stayed here ever since. And my wife was waiting for me there. She knew I was there. We were married at Vermont and Exposition, and that's about it.
Well, let me take you back to a couple things that I want to understand. You mentioned going to Buchenwald, and you even mentioned that in the years since, you've had people tell you how that never happened. And you said, I know it did because I was there. Before you got there, had you heard anything about what the Germans were doing to the Jewish people and other political prisoners? You were aware.
Oh, sure. We all knew it.
I just became aware of this recently because my grandfather was part of the liberation of Buchenwald, as I shared with you. There's an effort right now to put a memorial at Buchenwald honoring the liberators, the American liberators of that concentration camp. But because that was under the Iron Curtain and there's still that old socialist East German legacy, there's this version of the history there that says, no, the Americans didn't liberate the camp. It was the Polish communists inside the camp who liberated themselves.
No,
do you have any opinion on that?
Sure, I do. No, we liberated it. The reason the German guards left, because they knew we were coming. We liberated that camp, not Polish communists.
you know, when you talked about being at Buchenwald and you mentioned the people who have questioned that, I get the sense that it's important to you that the truth be known, that what you saw be remembered, and that that history be recorded. So can you help us understand some of the things you saw, even those things that maybe aren't easy to talk about?
Of course. The first things we saw were these skeletons scattered all over. It was terrible. Then there was a basement, or a cellar, I guess, and they had chains where people were hung up by their arms in there. And then, of course, the ovens and the showers. Those were all outstanding things in my mind that I can't ever forget. And I have pictures of some of that. They had towers and so on.
And I know it was a long time ago. In fact, 75 years ago, right around your birthday, it'll be the 75th anniversary of that liberation. So I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember how that struck you, how a young man processed such horrific circumstances and scenes?
Yes, I do. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that they devised things like that for other humans. It was unbelievable to me. Yes, it wasn't something I just left off. I just couldn't believe what I saw, but that's the way it was.
Well, thank you for your willingness to talk about that. I know it can't be easy. And, you know, you mentioned earlier when I asked you about close calls, you said, yeah, sure, I had close calls. I'm curious, though, about your state of mind, because here you are a world away from where you grew up and everything you've ever known, and you're dealing with the worst winter ever and an enemy that wants to kill you.
Sure.
Were you scared? Were you frightened?
Sure. Sure, I was scared, and I expected to be killed. I didn't expect to come home. I didn't know, of course, but guess God had other plans for me. But sure, I was scared. We're all scared. It's something you don't get over easily.
And I understand it's something that you didn't talk about for a long time.
Yeah, they didn't know anything about this until recent years.
Your family had no idea?
Well, Eleanor might have, but I never talked to them. They never do.
And I'm interested, too. So you go through all of this in Europe. You survive the Battle of Bulge, where thousands of Americans were killed. You witness the worst of humanity at Buchenwald. Germany surrenders, but you still have to head to Japan. You're thinking you're going to be part of a spearhead, which means you're probably going to be killed there in this invasion.
Oh, Eisenhower told us that the 200 will be dead the first day. He told us that.
And they estimated American casualties could have been around 1 million had they invaded Japan. So then when Imperial Japan surrendered, was that a relief to you?
Oh, sure. Of course, it was a big relief. We were surprised because they don't give up, but they did. The general came in and took over the administration of Japan. What was his name?
MacArthur.
MacArthur. This guy knows the history. MacArthur. Remember that on the exam. MacArthur did a good job administering Japan and putting things back together.
So when you came home, you had a fresh start? You could put all this behind you? Or what was your state of mind at that point?
Well, state of mind was, how do I make a living? I'm 23. I was in 4 years. So I talked it over with Eleanor, and we decided to take advantage of the GI Bill. Well, I started at Compton. Eventually went to the dental school. They had 3,000 applications. They only take 100. I knew the grades were important, so I concentrated on that, and I was lucky to get in.
And that worked out all right for you?
Well, I think so, but I had to have the permission of my wife because, as you know, you can't just leave. But she worked. She had a nice job.
So you become a dentist. And then you got bored? You decided you needed to do more?
No, I wasn't bored. I just felt I wanted to learn some more. But I had to work for it. It didn't just come easy.
And you went back to school to become an oral surgeon?
Oh, yeah. I went to San Francisco. I was there for 3 years. I became an oral surgeon.
And you were an expert on the jaw, from what I understand, the mandible?
I don't know if I was an expert, but I think what's missing today is common sense. People don't have common sense.
So you're a practicing dentist. You go back to school to become an oral surgeon. And then even after that, you decided, I want to be a regular medical doctor. Where did that come from?
Well, again, I wanted to advance myself. and I was willing to work. I didn't just stop. I worked weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. I worked 7 days a week, which people don't do today. They want to have fun. You look at the television, they're either drinking, laughing, or something. I don't know what the hell they're doing.
Not Dr. Cott recommended?
No. Not if you want to get ahead. People want the money. They want to get ahead. But you can't do it if you don't work for it. They don't want to work and still get the money.
So you had to be one of the oldest medical students ever, I'm guessing.
I was. I was 60 years old.
And I'm curious, as I think about that and all the work and the time you had to invest in those goals of becoming a dentist and then an oral surgeon and then a medical doctor, was any of your experience in the war and the perspective that gave you, did that influence any of those decisions or how you lived after the war?
I don't know. I think what influenced me the most was my childhood. I just felt I should do something to secure myself. I didn't hear from one family member during the war. Nobody wrote to me. I didn't have any family. My mother had 5 brothers and sisters. None of them wrote to me. It means a lot to me to have 4 great-grandchildren, too.
Well, I don't want to leave out anything that's important. And if there's anything else that you want to insert, let me know. I understand in recent years, as you've talked about this more, you've had some opportunities to meet the family of one of the Buchenwald survivors that you helped liberate, that you've been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., that you've even met Steven Spielberg with his Shoah Foundation documenting the Holocaust. What have some of those experiences been like for you?
We got memories. That's the whole bottom line of all this stuff is memories. It was quite a deal.
Well, it may seem obvious or intuitive or that it doesn't need to be said, but I'd like to hear it in your words, in your perspective. Why is it important that the story of Buchenwald and the other concentration camps and the Holocaust be told? Why do you think that's important?
First of all, I think that all of history is important because you know what the country is all about. For example, this idea of taking down statues of the pre-bellum years, that's part of history. You don't remove that. That doesn't change anything. So I think that this should be known also for future, that you can't allow people like Hitler and Mussolini to progress to the status that they had.
So if we're ignorant of the facts, even the painful facts that you saw firsthand, we're in danger of history repeating itself?
Well, certainly. If people don't know what they're doing, which they don't know many times today, especially, people don't know what they're doing. It could repeat itself. That's how you live the present. See, if you know history, you know what happened, and you could adjust your thinking and your goals and what you like to do today. History is a very good subject. I recommend people should learn history, but that's how you learn what's going on today, by the things of the past.
Well, like I said, I don't want to leave anything out, but I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for giving us a glimpse of history and sharing your perspective with us. I do have one more question for you. 97 and a half years old, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm most thankful to God for allowing me to live this long, because I have had a good life, irrespective of all these things. I've been in good health, except till now. Also, one should be very careful of diet. Try to eat things that come out of the ground, fruits, vegetables, low meat, not too much. You don't have to eliminate it, but just follow a reasonable diet. You have a glass of wine a day, it's all right, but you are what you eat. If you eat garbage, well, that's the way it'll turn out. In general, for a good life, you have to eat well.
Doctor's orders, huh?
Well, that's what I feel.
So here's my last thing. Thank you for being so generous with your time. And if you don't want to answer, don't. But when I think about your son sitting right here, grandkids and now great-grandkids, and the fact that none of them would have existed if you didn't make it back from World War II, I'm wondering if there's one situation that more than any other you look back on and say, that could have been it for me, and I'm really thankful it wasn't?
That's hard to say. Could have been any time. Bullets going around, and you had to be very careful. You know, you don't know. Might be in the back of you, and you don't know what happened. That's a hard one to answer. I don't think that that's very helpful or useful for a conversation. So what? Whatever incident it was, it didn't happen. So why even talk about it?
That's the way he felt, and perhaps that focus was a big part of his inspirational life story. It's time for another break, but when we come back, we'll talk to one of those people who he inspired the most, his son, Paul. I know it's a little different feel today with that news that this remarkable World War II veteran, Dr. Bill Cott, who we sat down to record with just over a week ago, passed away January 8th at the age of 97. I'm very thankful we had that privilege before it was too late. Please keep the Cott family in your prayers as they all reflect on the life he led, the impact he had, and the emotions all of that produces. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. In a bittersweet reality today, with a program that was recorded while Dr. Bill Cott and his powerful personality were still with us, but is airing now a week later in the wake of his passing at the age of 97. Dr. Cott's son, Paul, was present for the interview, and I wanted to share some of his perspective with you, especially when I realized that much of what we heard today was never mentioned while Paul was growing up. I started by asking him if, in those childhood years, he was even aware that his father had served in World War II.
I knew he was a veteran because in a closet in our garage were his military jackets and clothing. And we still have them, by the way. We still have his full outfit of jacket, sergeant shirt with a chevron emblazoned on, pants, socks, the gloves that he was talking about. The only thing we don't have, I think, is the boots. We still have the hat. So I treasure those things. And his trunk, his Army trunk with his name on it. But more than anything, just to add a postscript to everything that you both have been talking about, is what formed his life has helped form our lives, my brother and I's lives, because we don't take for granted anything. Because of what you said, it was God's will that my dad made it through that very difficult time, for whatever the reasons were, poor German marksmanship or divine intervention or who knows what. And lo and behold, here we are, and so we have to make the best of it. And that's been my dad's whole life, is taking what is his the hand that he was dealt, and even though it wasn't a good hand, to make the best of it. And if we can wake up every day and make the best of that day, no matter what might come, then we stand a good chance of adding to that day. And the cumulative effect of making the most out of every day makes for a good life. So, because so many people don't, and they don't have that guidance. In our case, I was fortunate. We were fortunate because we had something he didn't have. We had parental guidance that kind of gave us a great springboard into life. Gave us a great foundation to build our own lives out of. And my dad gave us enough latitude to make our own mistakes, learn from those mistakes, try not to make them again, and give us enough desire to and reasons to want to build on those mistakes. The old adage of, it's not if you're going to fall down or not, we're all going to fall down. It's how you get back up and what you do once you're back up on your feet. And so my brother and I, we've had our share of situations where they didn't go our way and things like that, but we try to build on it. But we always lean back to what my father and his father, even though his father and he were somewhat estranged, I think about that. I think about coming here from another country, in their case, to escape whatever the factors were at the time, and probably to come to another country to save their own life.
They escaped the German Empire in World War I?
Yeah, and so consequently, persecution of one sort or another. And when you do that, you leave behind your family, you leave behind your culture, you leave behind your language, you leave behind your wealth. And when I say your wealth, I don't mean any great wealth. I mean whatever wealth you might have had, whatever degree that might have been. And it doesn't matter the measure, you leave it behind because you're not going to come back and get it. And back then, it was not as simple as it is now. You can take a jet plane and be on the other side of the earth, you know, by tomorrow, not then. Once you left on a boat, and you're not coming back. Chances of coming back were so remote, there was not even a discussion item. So when you leave all that behind, you'd only do so to save your life and to know that your family's future, no matter how small your family is or how big it is, your family's future is going to be better in a new place, in a new country, than it was in the country that you're leaving, even though you don't possess language skills, you don't possess whatever it might need, you need to possess, you don't possess relationships in your new country. You have to give up your life so that future generations can lead a better life. And this is so disturbing in today's culture for me, and I try to do what I can to help educate. Because a lot of people come here from other countries. I've dealt for many years with people from other countries, kids especially. They don't appreciate the fact that their parents and their maybe even grandparents gave up their whole lives so that they can have a better life here. And this is something I live my life by the example that was set by grandparents and my parents being a son of immigrants that came looking for a better life, looking for that opportunity.
And I get the sense that, you know, specifically with his role in the liberation of Buchenwald and a witness to history there, that your understanding of that has been almost like peeling layers of an onion the last couple of years, that you really didn't know the extent of it?
Indeed.
What can you tell us about that? When did that world open up to your understanding?
I would say in the last 20 years, American society has been more welcoming of veterans coming back to this country, providing them with things that they need to help them assimilate back into mainstream society, and demonstrate more gratitude towards veterans of previous wars, Korean Wars, World War II. It's evidenced by memorials, monuments, museums that have been built past 20 years. New Orleans, Washington, D.C., different examples of gratitude, programs that have been set forth by government to help veterans, give them a hand up, home buying, for example,
sure.
That sort of thing. Programs at sporting events, all over. If someone knows that you're a veteran, they almost can't help themselves but to say thank you for your service. Doesn't even matter what war they were in. Thank you for your service is a common part of American jargon now. It's very typical to hear that. It's not unusual to see a serviceman in uniform at a restaurant. His bill will be taken care of. So in the past 20 years, there's been more focus, more of a spotlight on veterans, their plight, and what they come back to live by. Because in my dad's era, they didn't talk about PTSD and things like that. These guys, they just came in and had to just somehow place their past 4 years or 2 years, whatever it was. They had to compartmentalize that in some place and put it somewhere. And some of the guys put it pretty deep in a place where no one ever goes. So my dad was one of those guys. He never talked about it. He was too busy with trying to take his experience and make it something positive, I believe. And he lived by that. It wasn't just talk. He walked that talk. And it wasn't just talk. And so consequently, my brother and I learned by that, and we have lived our life in that same mode. And we hope that our kids we'll learn from that as well. And we can't emphasize enough that freedom is not free, and somebody paid the price for that. And in our case, I guess if it wasn't for guys like Dad, we'd all be speaking German or Japanese.
And you certainly wouldn't have been one of 17,000 plus at a Anaheim Ducks game cheering for your dad. That's when he right. was on it. What was that like? What kind of emotions did that stir?
Prideful ones. For most of the people there, my dad was just another guy who had served his country and another wartime hero of sorts that got recognized for his service and for his contribution to his country. But for as a family member to watch all those people and dad was speechless. And as you can see, that's hard to do.
And is it true that you didn't know until about the last year or so that he had actually taken photos at Buchenwald?
That's right. We had moved my father from his home that he lived in for 60 years. And in so doing, we uncovered a lot of old family memorabilia, including his trunk of his army clothing and military things, weapons, ammo, photographs, all kinds of amazing keepsakes, probably some authorized, some otherwise. But it was certainly a treasure trove of history and of family participation that my dad got to experience firsthand and has gotten to share with his family, which I'm very grateful for. One of the amazing benefits of all this, Paul, is kind of my dad has become this sort of local celebrity given his age and given his accomplishments. Consequently, as I mentioned, he gets asked frequently to participate in things involving the Holocaust and different things, including the programs involving the survivors of the Holocaust, which are well chronicled here, and one about my father as well. And so that, and then the meeting with the Shoah Foundation with Steven Spielberg was an amazing opportunity. And we were literally in a private area with Tom Hanks and his wife and Steven Spielberg and his wife and his father talking about World War II. And for about a half hour before we all had to go out to a dinner, my father says, he kind of looks back at me and says, do you have any idea who these people are? And I said, well, yeah, Dad, they're really famous people. And he said, really? He said, what are they famous for? And so I told him, he says, well, let's eat and just get out of here. I want to go home.
Priorities. Well, last thing, and again, if there's something you want to add, feel free. If I were coming at you out of the blue and hadn't heard everything we've been hearing from your dad and from you, and I just said, tell me about your dad. Who's your dad? What's he all about? How would you describe him? How do you see him?
The word that jumps right out off the page to me is integrity. What you see is what you get. You don't have to guess. It's no baloney. It's just you ask a question, he'll give you the answer. The way from his perspective. And his perspective is what worked for him for his whole life. My father has a unique perspective in that he had to be a survivor. He was chronicled as the liberator, but from what he had to come out of as a kid and as a young man, from his family situation, from that very stoic East European upbringing. There wasn't 1 minute of frivolity. Hmm. There wasn't any normal things that most kids grow up with today. It was, everything was, every day was serious. Every day was, how are you going to survive today? And then he gets in the service, and every day, literally, how are you going to survive today? You don't know the password? You got to, what are you going to eat? You know, how are we going to survive the night? How are we going to survive the elements? So at age 22, 23, 24, when he was discharged, that was his foundation. That was his foundation. He had to be a scrapper. He had to be someone who had to go out and get it. With that in mind, he had to fight for everything that he had. Like he said, working 7 days a week wasn't a big deal to him. And you talk to somebody now and say, hey, how would you like to work 7 days a week? They'd look at you like you're crazy. But it was just what he had to do to get it done. And so these are the things that, you know, who's my dad? My dad is a guy that started with zero and ended up with a lot. I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about some incredible blessings, family and good health, good friends. When you boil it all down, that's a pretty good life.
Sounds like you're pretty proud of him.
Very much so.
Paul Kott talking about his father, Dr. Bill Kott, who finished his journey here on Earth January 8th at the age of 97. I don't know about you, but I heard a lot of things today that give me pause, that give me a little perspective. I'm very thankful for the privilege of sharing Dr. Kott's story with you today. Again, please do keep the family in your prayers. That's all the time we have for Hometown Heroes this time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.